Hello and welcome to The Wound Doctors, a podcast series dedicated to the study and improved treatment of wounds. These episodes are brought to you by ConvaTec, pioneering trusted medical solutions to improve the lives they touch. My name's Rod Murray, and if you caught our last episode, it was a bit of a wrap-up of some of the interviews we managed to snag at the Wounds Australia conference in Sydney last month. If you haven't had a listen to that, you need to first question your life choices, and second, go and do so. However, there's a serious note to today's episode because we deliberately left out of that episode two of the most important interviews we did that week. Now, there's a good reason we did that, and it'll become clear as we go on today why. When I say we, I mean not just me, but my much cleverer and more medically knowledgeable co-host, Dr. Fran Henshaw. Dr. Fran, looking forward to highlighting a quite difficult issue on today's episode, health inequality in the Aboriginal community in Australia, still a shameful reality in 2022.
It is, unfortunately, Rod, and we were very lucky to get people who have quite a high level of expertise within this remit to actually explain not just, you know, the breadth of the problem, but actually to offer some solutions, which I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, these aren't simple issues, or they would have been solved long ago. There's a lot of nuance and lots of layers to it, which came through in both of the conversations. I want to look at these two one at a time. Leslie Salem and Professor James Charles are the two guests that we spoke to. Let's have a look into Leslie first. Now, anyone who knows you, Fran, knows that you're generally, unless you get wound up, quite a bubbly and happy person. You weren't so bubbly and happy when you came back from Leslie's presentation at the conference. Give us a quick snippet of what that was about. Then I'm going to play some clips from Leslie that'll give us a bit of an
idea. So Leslie Salem is a nurse practitioner who works in Aboriginal health in the Gulf in far north Queensland. And, you know, I was very interested to see what was going on in that part of the world because it's not somewhere I get to very often. And then she explained in graphic detail that life expectancy there was only 49 years old, which, you know, in a country like Australia is shameful.
And I'd be gone, Fran. That's me done a couple of years ago. And when you think about it like that, it puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And the root cause of a lot of this early mortality was actually wounds. Can you believe it, Rob?
Oh, it's quite stunning. Let's have a listen to Leslie explains quite succinctly here what is the cause of issues in the Northern Gulf there in Queensland.
Yes, even though the wounds are caused by Staph aureus, they get secondary strep A infections. The body has an immune response to this, and then it attacks the heart valves. So children as young as 4, 5, 6 end up with heart failure from rheumatic heart disease. And the only treatment for that is IM bicillin, which is equivalent to the thickness of toothpaste. So they have to have 2 mils of practically toothpaste injected into their buttocks every 21 to 28 days for 10 years.
There's an awful lot to unpack in that, Fran. There's a lot of information in there. I want to start with some of the big words at the beginning. Staph aureus and something else that Leslie said there. Is that fairly common? What are we talking about? Are these really complicated wounds that are causing this tragic? Children as young as 7 dying of heart failure. This is an unthinkable situation. So are we talking about something quite simple to begin with?
Look, I'm not really an expert in this kind of tropical medicine, but let me just give you my kind of lay version. And that's, you know, all kids get scrapes and sores and things like that. And people who are in hot countries and perhaps living in conditions where there's more obstacles and more opportunity to fall over and things like that get what they call school sores. And they also get just bacterial infections in their skin, probably due to the heat and humidity, which cause sores as well. Now, it's usual for sores to have Staphylococcus aureus in. That's probably the most common thing that we find. But I think there's some kind of microcosm up there that's causing them to get strep A. And strep A is a less usual bug. And apparently, once you have about 3 or 4 episodes of these school sores, or impetigo as it's often known, with strep A, this is when people go on to get rheumatic heart disease. So the strep A goes to the heart valves and actually causes trouble with them. And the other thing that Leslie was talking about is that because these sores are so transmissible and because they're so, are dreadful in the consequences that they have, that when children have them, they're not able to go to school. So there's a twofold problem, is that we've got kids not going to school because of school sores, and then we've got kids who are dying young of heart failure because of the consequences of having multiple episodes. It's really desperately tragic.
And is it predominantly a geographic problem? Is that what you're suggesting? You know, the humidity, the weather conditions of that part of the world, as opposed to, or is this something that was prominent in Western society until we came up with a very simple solution? I'm trying to figure out.
I'm probably not the person to ask, but I did have an interesting conversation at a conference I was at this weekend in Melbourne, actually, and I was talking to some podiatrists from Thursday Island up in the Torres Strait, and mindful of what Leslie was saying was happening in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I said to them, do you have this problem there? And they said, no, we think that's more far north Queensland, on the northern end and the Northern Territory. So I can only speculate that it is a geographic thing, and whether that's to do with climate, living circumstances or what have you, I'm really not too certain.
Indeed. Here's what
Leslie... Not often I say that, is it?
No, it's not. I'm just wondering, did you tell you were in a conference at Melbourne at the weekend? Weren't you in Paris last week? Do you have a home, friend? Do you need a home? Do you just live out of a suitcase?
I feel like I need some sleep at the moment more than anything, Rod. I had to fly back from Paris straight to a conference in Melbourne. And my colleague looked after me so well, I had to go for a nana nap at 9:30 in the morning, actually.
That's fair enough after an industrial. Here's what Leslie says needs to be done.
We need a lot of work by good master's students, postgraduate students, PhD students, because there is no evidence on what we should be using on these wounds to prevent rheumatic heart disease.
So you're in dressings, Fran. You're a wound expert. Convatec is in dressings. Are dressings, quite possibly, wound dressings, the solution to this really tragic problem?
Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to Leslie and they use very basic kind of cloth type dressings. It's very hard to get anything to stick in that climate. And then I dragged into the conversation Dan Metcalf, who was actually in last week's podcast, and he's from the R&D team, and he's helped to make a lot of dressings. And I explained the story, and I was, you know, I was getting quite outraged, actually. And I was saying, Dan, we have to do something. And Dan's quite a sensible chap, and he could see that he needed to do something.
His eyes actually lit up, didn't they, Fran? Because for somebody like Dan, this is a genuine challenge where the outcome can really have a positive impact on not just one, but multiple people's lives.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have advanced wound dressings that have antibiofilm, so they're antibacterial, and they have other agents in that help to get through all the sludge in the wound and down to the bacteria. And, you know, these could probably be real game changers. But obviously we've got to find a good way to secure them, and we've got to trial them. So, you know, I think there's immense appetite from Convatec to do this. I've leveraged the tribe, and I've got my colleagues from Western Sydney University, where I am still a conjoint, and they're happy to, you know, help to design a trial and get the ethics. And obviously it's important in these places that we need to engage with the local First Nations people and get buy-in from them. So I think Leslie's looking at that aspect of it at the moment. But I truly think that we may have a tool that can help these people. And, you know, we really need to try it in quite a robust and rigorous way so that we can actually make a solution that essentially saves lives.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, usually when I talk about saving lives and wounds, it's, you know, someone not dying of sepsis when they're an old person with a diabetic foot ulcer, not a child who's got school sores.
Yeah. So it rams at home, doesn't it? Leslie talked about 7-year-old children dying. And anybody who knows a 7-year-old child or people with a 7-year-old child, it's an unthinkable outcome for anybody, particularly if it is preventable. Well, I can say, Fran, I know from personal experience, if you're wound up about something, people are going to get things done. So good on you for getting cracking on that. One of the things you said there was really interesting and leads nicely into our second interview that I thought was really important with Professor James Charles. He's a professor at the Griffith University, and he's working with students and the medical profession to get to have medical practitioners more culturally aware of First Nations Indigenous people's issues, and also to try to get more Indigenous people themselves into health practitioner roles. And this sort of thing, when there's nobody on the inside from that culture, makes it difficult for us on the outside to work with them, doesn't it? One of the problems you mentioned, you can't just march into the Gulf with Leslie and say, right, we've got the solution, we're going to fix it. In fact, Professor James says that's the last thing you should do.
Absolutely. And we know that people, for example, in tertiary education, First Nations people are very underrepresented. But, you know, there's a lot of barriers for them to be able to get into tertiary education. And it's not necessarily just about getting the grades to get in. It's about, you know, leaving your community and things like that, that is very difficult.
Good numbers start, don't they, Fran? But then lots of those people leave the system.
Yeah, because I think that it's not really suited to them. Yeah. And, you know, you make a lot of life changes when you go off to tertiary education. And if no one else in your family has ever done it and they may not quite understand why you want to do it, I think it can be very difficult to stick. But I think that it's really important. And I think the wonderful thing about James Charles is that, you know, he's trodden the path. He's a podiatrist like me, actually. And, you know, I taught podiatry for 7 years and we didn't have very many First Nations students. We had a couple. But for somebody to go through that, do a PhD and then set up this whole, you know, research unit that's actually looking at this issue of health inequity and how to get people who work in health more culturally aware, you know, that's a great step in the right direction. Yeah.
James was really careful during the interview to sort of constantly make the point that many of the mistakes that we make in the white community when dealing with people in First Nations community are innocence, not ignorance, and they're not malice, but we just don't understand sometimes what we're saying. He had some really interesting things to say about humility. Here's a clip from Professor James.
Look, some of the big things, it's really around, I suppose it's that understanding, you know, really, and I think patience. You know, people are in a hurry. I understand that. Yeah. People want to get things done. So they often go to community where they want to help, and it's perhaps, you know, whether it's remote, regional, or in the city. You know, often I've worked in Sydney, and I think there's just as many issues from my point of view as there are in some remote places, but people need to have an understanding of the time it takes to build that rapport. So first of all, you need to have some sort of understanding, but then you can't rush in. Don't rush in. Don't start, you know, because people are busy. I understand that. Their time's important and they're very, you know, important people. But you need to sort of, I think, leave some of that, or can I say ego, at the door a little bit when you go into community. Understand, appreciate the intelligence, the you know, cultural knowledge and indigenous knowledges that we've had for a very long time. So appreciating that, but humility. Humility, and that's part of what I was saying about sometimes people go to community, you know, and rightfully they are proud of their training as a podiatrist or physio or yeah, whatever it might be, and they've done a master's and they've done a PhD and all of those things. But I would advise people not to go into community.
We're here to fix.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I think we're all guilty of being that person, aren't we, Fran? And particularly, less so me, obviously, but particularly I would imagine people who are medically trained and know the answers to some of these problems, just assuming that they will walk in and have the respect of everybody there without needing to do anything.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to what James was saying about, you know, innocence rather than ignorance. I think people, you know, when you know that First Nations people have such poor health outcomes, often it can seem very linear of what you need to do to improve it. It's like, if you do this, you will get better. Well, it's not how these people want to consume their healthcare. And I think you need to be very, very aware of that. And I know that when I worked at the university, we had a clinic at the university where we would take appointments for the general public, and we would have Aboriginal people that would come in, and they often didn't want to come to our clinic. So we actually started going to an Aboriginal medical centre, and it was much more successful. And the reason it was successful is they were being treated by students. They're an environment that they actually felt comfortable in, and they really felt that they could give back to the community by helping to educate our students to become more culturally competent and aware. So it became a two-way street, not just somebody consuming healthcare. So I think, you know, that's an example of where it does work very well.
Yeah. It's easy to see how you could become frustrated as a health practitioner under those circumstances, but the industry and the people in the industry, they owe patients more than that, don't they? You've got to go beyond that frustration and say, okay, well, that's frustrating, but what is the way to go? What is the answer? There's room on both sides, isn't there? Both sides need to sort of move in some way.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is challenging when you're a health professional and, you know, my dad, who gets brought up on this podcast quite a lot.
He just won't listen.
If you ask him his medical history, he won't just go, you know, 1963 broken leg, 1988 tonsils out, 1994 cataracts. It'll be like, well, I remember one year I was in the shed, and, you know, and it goes on and on like that. And sometimes, you know, it's very frustrating as a healthcare practitioner where you know that you just want to dig the facts out, but you've got to sit through a lot of the fluff around them before you do that. But I think there's an art form to it, and you can't just shut these people up and get the facts out of them. You have to kind of listen. And then I think, you know, they feel like they're valued.
People skills are probably an overlooked part of medicine, aren't they? It is critical that medical practitioners have really good people skills, communication skills, the ability to listen and adapt to dealing with different people. We don't think about that, do we? But it's maybe more important than some of the stuff you learn out of books.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's, you know, if you ask the right question, then you get much more information than if you just, you know, kind of get someone to fill out a form. So I think that you have to learn to kind of dig a little bit deeper, and, you know, taking time with your patients really does pay dividends. And I remember listening to an interview with Patch Adams, who's, you know, the chap in the US, and he was saying that everyone should have 4 hours with their doctor. I mean, we'd need an awful lot of doctors if you did that. But I do think that a lot of people would get better health outcomes if they weren't, you know, just feeling like they were on some kind of a conveyor belt.
It's the problem with systems, isn't it, Fran? You've got to have a system, which means there's got to be things like time limits and whatnot imposed on, you know, what is the standard length of a consultation. None of those things, of course, make sense in reality, do they? They're just the parameters you have to set, or the system falls down.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's no way around it. Here's what I really like about what James is doing and what Griffith University is doing. Well, there's accreditation processes now. People have to complete these cultural awareness courses and have some of this understanding. It's proactive, isn't it, Fran? We spoke to James about the possibility. This is probably a generational shift that's going to happen. It'll happen slowly, but it has to start somewhere, and this feels like the start of it, yeah?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the people who accredit health professions, which is a body called APRA, have now mandated cultural competence in the training of these healthcare professionals. And, you know, when things are accessible and have to be done, then that drives learning. And learning and increase of knowledge will downstream probably mean that people will become more culturally aware and, you know, the situation will improve.
Yeah. And James is a fantastic person to have at the forefront of that, I think. I thought he was a fabulous speaker and had those people skills we were just talking about in abundance. So perfect person for it. Dr. Fran, what a week it was at the – well, 3 days at the Wounds Conference. It did feel like a week, obviously. You must have almost forgotten it. You've been to so many conferences already since. But it was a joy to be there and hear and meet some really impressive, incredible people, including the two people that we've had today. So it's been terrific to give a little bit of a wrap-up of what happened there. And thank you for taking some time again today. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, well, Rod, I think that you are heading towards becoming a real wound expert now that we've not only dragged you into the podcast studio every 2 weeks, but we've dragged you to a conference as well. So maybe you can do a presentation at the next one.
Well, I did cut myself the other day, Fran. I looked much more closely at what I'd done than I ever had before I put a Band-Aid on it. I don't know what I was looking for, but I felt like I must know more than I used to. So I looked quite hard at the cut that I'd made on my finger. You won't make
excellent. We're making progress.
Well, you won't make a doctor out of me, unfortunately, but I have been listening somewhat. That's it for this episode of The Wound Doctors. We'll be back to do it all again here on The Wound Doctors.